Premier Radio Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Along with investigative reporter Paula Harris and Charles Hall with his incredible story, we'll be back with both of them in just a moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back with Paula Harris and Charles Hall. Paula, before we go back to Charles, you said that with the help of an L.A. police officer, Natalie, you were able to find, a couple other people from Nellis?
Yes, one other in particular, the person that Charles called Little Jimmy Payne, who has another name, and we had looked. We had originally hired a private investigator to find this person, and David Coot and I didn't find him, and then we asked Steve to jump in. He's a great listener of yours, and he in about a week found him, and we were able to call him and so forth and verify all the stories that the poker stories and all the stories that Charles had said that he had lived with these people on the base, and this man remembered him very well, remembered the legend of Range 4 Harry. But it occurred to us at the time that Charles was very special, that Charles was the only one that really could live through this experience, because the other people, as he mentioned, had trouble, and a lot of them, he said, a lot of weathermen before him, so that something was special about Charles's way of dealing with life, and he'll tell you his way of dealing with fear, where he was able to actually live with these people for a year and a half and come away with it to be able to talk about it. And I think that's the crux of this whole entire story. I'm beginning to believe anymore that some kind of accord was made by these people and the military not to hinder Charles in any way from telling this story.
Well, that may be true. Charles, you feel as if with the book, the Millennial Hospitality Series, and what you're saying tonight, that they would endorse you, they being in government right now? Or do you think they're back cringing, going, oh, no, Charles, don't say this?
I would think they would endorse me because my book is not confrontational. It doesn't criticize the government in any way or the tall whites. It doesn't advocate any change in policy, or it doesn't, there aren't any, it doesn't, say, gee, what should have been, what could have been. What I'm trying to do in the book is simply to capture the emotions that I felt and convey them to the reader. And I had to change the names of people and places in the book to protect the innocents, myself included. I had to change a few of the distances and directions in order to protect myself, and also, because it's not my intention to upset anyone. What I'm trying to do simply is to convey my emotions.
Are the stories fiction based on fact, or is it all true?
Everything in the book is fact.
Okay.
The only thing I changed was the names of the people in the place.
All right.
To protect the innocent.
Fair enough. Now, right before the top of the hour break, as we were leading into this hour, you were stumbling across almost where they might have been from, and you said they seemed a little shocked, dismayed. Why don't you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Sure. And I should also say that I'm very happy with the picture of the tall white lady that is on Paula Harris's website, because that matches. Paula and I were communicated carefully on that. And that tall white lady stood about 6'2", and she was, and there was a very particular tall white lady that picture matches.
And Paula, that's the one made by Teresa Barbatelli?
Barbatelli here in Italy, but we had three artists working on this, George. I mean, we gave Charles at least, nine different drawings, and he couldn't say they all were perfect, so what we did, he said that the tall white lady that he calls the teacher looked like the model Twiggy. I don't know if you remember the model Twiggy in the 70s.
Sure,
he said she had big eyes. They have wraparound blue eyes, and she had a very thin body like the model Twiggy. So we started with that, And then we tried to get these Italian artists to work on it, but I think ultimately, and it'll debut on your website first,
it is up there right now, I think. Just the picture of Teresa that you gave us is up on the website.
Okay, now you're going to get a composite from a forensic artist from the Anaheim Police Department, thanks to Steve Natale.
Yeah.
For the first time ever, we've got cooperation from someone not on police time, but on her own private time.
I understand.
Works as a forensics artist, and she's going to give you the actual face of the according to Charles' really intricate description of the teacher.
I gotta tell you, these tall whites, Paula and Charles, kind of look like the alien Greys with a wig on. You know, they've got that kind, that eye shape and everything else.
They're definitely not Greys. The Greys are the ones that, who were related to the Roswell incident.
Yeah.
They're definitely not Greys. You probably couldn't get a tall white and a Grey in the same room without having one awful battle.
So there is friction there.
Oh, big time. They fight like cats and dogs.
Why is that?
I can only guess, but... because as I say, no one ever came to me and explained anything. I had to just figure it out for myself.
Have they been warring, do you think?
I can only guess. I wouldn't think they were. I don't think they're fighting openly, but I can only guess. Answers to questions like that, I can only answer questions based on my personal experience, and I don't have any personal experiences in that area. But the tall whites were individuals, just like humans, and both in shape and appearance, but also, just like humans, but also in terms of personality too. So, the lady, for example, the whose picture is on Paula's website, or we based the sketch on,
yeah.
She was somewhat more nervous than most tall white women. But not unduly so, because she was perfectly willing to come with her guards and with three children that were with her.
Her guards being other tall whites or being military, U.S. military?
No, other tall white guards. When I was out at the ranges, usually the tall whites came with just tall whites. They only came with American generals.
Were they armed?
To the teeth, yeah. They were always, the adults were always armed. The children weren't. And when they got old enough, they weren't.
Why would they be walking around with weapons?
Because they know what humans are like, okay? Because once the human panics, they may have to protect themselves.
Okay, so they were fully aware that at any point they could be in jeopardy.
Oh, yeah. See, from their point of view, we're built like gorillas. We could fall down and break a leg, and then in a month, 6 weeks, we were up and running again. If they fell down and broke a leg, it took them like 5 years to heal up.
Of course, they lived 400 to 700 years, didn't they?
Yeah, and see, they're way frailer than we are. They never wanted to be touched by a human. They never came out to shake hands or to touch me or anything.
Not emotional?
Well, they're emotional like we are, but they're not. And between themselves, they certainly touch each other and stuff between themselves. But you know how, like, when I go to the zoo, I never want to touch a gorilla, and I doubt the gorilla ever wants to touch me.
Yeah, but you would pet a little monkey. You'd pet a puppy.
I never have pet a monkey. Okay.
All right, I have.
Yeah, and they're like that. They when they came out, they're not human, so they do see things, although they're very similar to us. They have all of our emotions and stuff. They treat the emotion of anger much differently than we do, but they don't come, when they would come, they wouldn't come and say hello. They wouldn't greet me when they came. They wouldn't say goodbye when they left. They came when they wanted, they left.
And they just turned around and left, huh?
Yeah, and if they didn't have anything to say in between, especially the men.
They just stood there.
Yeah, so you really might. So many times I might be out there watching, say taking my balloon readings, and three or four of them might step out from behind the Range 3 lounge and walk up and just stand, say, 10, 15 feet around and watching me.
What do they eat, Charles? What do they drink?
Well, they drink water and foods just like we do. And if they don't get water and foods, they die of thirst just like we do. And they're plant eaters. They don't eat meat at all. They have no desire whatever for wool, clothing, or anything that has to do with animals. They're plant eaters. They don't have teeth. They have ridges instead of teeth. And the only food of theirs that I personally saw looked like mushroom pudding, which the teacher had prepared for the kids.
And of course, they devoured that.
Yeah, well, the teacher used to have this joke that she would tell about her the three kids that she would typically bring with her. One was a little fat by their standards, but not fat by human standards.
Right.
He was stouter. In my book, I call him the little fat astronaut. And the teacher used to have this dry joke. She used to say, he's the one that likes the food, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Implying that the other two used to...
I mean, were these kids good or were they brats?
The kids... All of the children perfectly behave to their parents. The idea that the child would disobey the parents was just out of the question. The children were just perfectly obedient. And the other side of the coin is the parents would do anything for their kids. As you see in my book, in book two entitled The Night of the Fathers, the tall white fathers probably broke every rule you can imagine just to come out and make sure that it was okay with me and also okay with them if the children came and played where I was.
In your opinion, Charles,
they would do anything for the kids.
What were they doing here?
Well, they were doing the same thing here that the U.S. Air Force or the U.S. Navy does with any military base. They were running a military base where the deep spacecraft would come on schedule, stand, you know, put in for repairs and refueling and refurbishing, and then stand out to deep space again. They were literally running an airport. You know, what it is what they're doing in the mountain is the same thing that happens at any airport. You know, every two, you know, and if you knew the airline schedule, you could tell which deep space was coming, how long it would be in port, and how long when it would leave.
And we freely let them come and go. Why?
The U.S. Air Force would do anything for technology transfer.
And you believe there has been?
Well, I'm quite certain of it. Although the tall whites, the tall whites are easy to negotiate with, but there has to be something in it for them. You know, like when you sat down and negotiated with them, like one of the first deals I negotiated with them after it took me more than 6 months to get over the terror and to get over the denial and to get over all the emotion to where I was willing to...
Of thinking about life elsewhere, things like that?
Yeah, for the first 6 months, as I describe in my book, I went through a lot of nights of white terror and stuff. And one of the first agreements I negotiated with them was that if I saw one of them out in the desert or, you know, out at the Range 3 Lounge, that I wouldn't come up behind them and scare them.
Mm-hmm.
And in return, they wouldn't come up behind me and scare me. And that if I saw them, I would just stand where I was and let them approach me as closely as they felt comfortable. And if they felt like turning and going away, I would never pursue. I would just stand there and let them go away. And vice versa, if they were coming up to me and they got too close so that I felt uncomfortable, that I would back away and they wouldn't pursue. They would let me back away until I felt comfortable. And they were quite happy to agree to that, but on the other side of the coin is they're sort of like Philadelphia lawyers. Once you make an agreement with them, they expect the human to observe the agreement to the letter, just as they themselves intend to observe the agreement to the letter. And so when you do make an agreement with them, you have to be careful to make sure that you've done everything you can to do that, see? And that worked quite well, because that would allow... Because, see, they're naturally as afraid of us, or more so than we are of them. And so, see, new arrivals might be too afraid to even be seen, to even step out from behind the lounge and let you see them. And see, only the experienced troops were willing to walk up to me and say, like, come within 5 or 10 feet of me and say hi.
How many were there?
Oh, one night, as I describe in book three, in the chapter entitled The End of Innocence, one night I saw more than somewhere between 200 and 300 of them lined up along the mountain to the east, and I couldn't count them all. I stopped counting at
a whole colony for crying.
Yeah, and they had more than 30, somewhere between 35 and 70 scout craft out there in the desert. I couldn't count them all because they were parked so close.
And what do the craft look like from the outside?
Oh, and they had the American generals with them on that night, by the way.
So they're obviously part of this. What the craft? I mean, oval shaped, like we've been told, triangular. What does it look like?
The craft are white and ellipsoidal. Now they have two kinds. They have the deep space craft,
bigger ones,
the much larger, and they are titanium black, and they are like ellipsoidal. And then they have the scout craft, which are built here on the Earth. The scout craft are white and ellipsoidal, and are like sort of like a flying RV, or sort of the size of a diesel truck with a double trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And the scout craft come in different sizes because they build them here. And they use parts supplied by the American Air Force, but the tall whites keep the anti-gravity propulsion system, that technology, in their hands. They haven't shared that with the Americans.
Are we trying to sneak it?
I have no idea, but...
George, can I say something about
this?
Yes,
you may.
Because we're listening to this. Again, I have to remind the listeners, we're in 1965, and Charles just said they were built on Earth. We have the scout craft built on Earth. So is it possible, and I just wrote a piece that I put on my website about this, is it possible that some of the UFO sightings that we're seeing are these scout craft that were built here, and we can't tell the difference between our technology and their technology anymore? I mean, what are we seeing? Are we seeing real UFOs, or are we seeing technology that goes back as far as 1965? So for me, this presents a lot of ethical questions, a lot of, the more I study this, the more questions come up about this particular thing.
But no doubt in your mind, Charles, that we are in cahoots with their visitation.
Oh, no question. After you saw the generals and the tall and their tall white counterparts, they would come through my barracks at night. I mean, when I say I saw the American generals with the tall whites, I mean they were like, from one end of my bunk to the other.
Did you ever see an argument between a tall white and a human?
Arguing with a tall white is a very dangerous undertaking. They don't handle anger the way we do.
Will they just kill you?
Or go away. If you're lucky, they'll just go away and won't deal with you. If you, if the tall white says, as I describe in book three, or book two and book one all over the place, if you're with a tall white and like if you're walking up towards one and he says the word no, stop there, he means exactly no, stop there.
What if you don't?
He'll kill you if he has to. If he has to, he will. Okay? When they say the word no, they mean exactly no. Right now, no. They seldom use the word no, but when they do use it, they mean it exactly. And so when you're arguing with it, I never saw a general argue with the tall white.
How would they kill you? With their super ray gun or what?
Oh, they had the set of weapons that worked on microwaves. And they all had them up like the sleeves on their clothing and stuff, and it was adjustable, and you could adjust it to stimulate the atoms of sodium or calcium or iodine. If they the typical one where they adjust it to sodium, if they fired it at you, it was kind of like touching a high voltage power line.
All right, this was 1965. Here we are now, 2005. Are they still out there?
They have to be. The base that they dug in, the base they had up in the mountains, had a perfect location from the point of view of a deep spacecraft. And I mean, the U.S. Air Force had poured a lot of concrete on that place. And I wouldn't think the tall whites would idly have wanted to move it.
Do you think by now we've picked up on their propulsion system 38, 9 years from now?
I can only guess, because the tall whites, they did not want to share the anti-grav drive, the various aspects of it with it. I have a theory called Hall photon theory, which I describe in book three, and which I describe what I believe is the physics of how they work. It starts from known American physics, experiments in the field of physics, because, as you know, I have a master's degree in physics. Things like the Michelson-Morley experiment and so on, and the water-filled telescope and the toroidal coil, and in which I describe how those should be analyzed.
Let's talk about that when we come back, Charles, and you as well, Paula. I'm going to ask you a few more questions about your investigation. I'm George Norrie with this fascinating story on Coast to Coast AM.
The official website of Coast to Coast AM is www.coasttocoastam.com. Log on now. Somewhere out there, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, tomorrow night's guest chat will be New York Times best-selling author William Burns. Bill Burns, of course, co-authored with the late Colonel Philip Corso the book The Day After Roswell. He will be our guest on Streamlink's chat tomorrow night. Also, Bill is my co-author. Bill and I are collaborating on a book together, and he'll tell you a little bit more about that on tomorrow's Streamlink chat, which will be 8 o'clock Pacific time, 11 o'clock Eastern time. After Dark newsletter comes out every month like clockwork. Set your watch to it. It's a dandy full color. You'll get Art Bell's free CD on Mel's Hole and also the Sounds of Hell by calling 1-888-727-5505, 1-888-727-5505. You can also order it online, safe and secure, right at the bottom of the homepage, coasttocoastam.com. Paula, with this story that happened 40 years ago, did you have any obstacles investigating the story?
No, and that's what's so strange about this, because this is the first thing I, you know, asked myself when I went with Captain David Coote to interview Charles. The first thing I thought when we walked out of his house said, how come we can talk about this? We looked at each other and said, how come this is okay? How come now in 2003, 2004, it is, you know, something that we can, is someone directing this disclosure? And George, I wanted to add that I am flying to the 14th Annual International UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada, and we'll be there with Charles on March 6th through 12th, so people can talk to him in person, and also at the X Conference in Washington, D.C., April 21st through 24th, this year. So Charles will be there both times with me at these places, which means he'll be speaking in public.
Charles, was there ever a time that you wanted to take pictures of the tall whites?
No, and the reason is because, remember, they came through my barracks at night.
Mm-hmm.
along with the American generals, and when you're actually out there with them, you know, your mind isn't, it's a very emotional experience. Your mind isn't on that at all. Your mind is on keeping yourself, at least in my case, my mind was on keeping myself alive. You know, once you realize that they were real and what the kind of technology they had and so on, you'd never want to, I mean, I'm out there by myself alone in the desert. If anything goes wrong, you know, I'm the one at risk. I took myself out there. I got to bring myself back.
Did you feel threatened at all?
Each one is individuals, and so how threatened a person felt depended entirely on who was present. One of their tall white generals, I didn't feel like he meant to do me harm, but on the other hand, he was a general. If he said stop there, he meant.
They were all business, weren't they?
Yeah. On the other hand, there were others, like the tall white, who used the CIA names, the school bus driver and the mechanic. They almost seemed like brothers. And Range 4 and I, you know, Range 4 Carrie and I, there's an actual tall white guard named that, communications officer. You know, he and I became, when he came around, it felt like you were talking to a brother or a first cousin. So how comfortable or how threatened you felt depended on who you were talking to. But even when you knew them, there was a great deal of tension or stress when they came around because they aren't human and they don't handle anger the way we do. And until they got to know humans very well, you know, you always had to be very careful. You know, you never wanted to make them angry.
Can you be a little more specific for us on where you think they might originate?
My best guess, and it was purely a guess on my part, is a star that's 105 light years away, but I don't know which one. I also wanted to say how much I appreciate the help from Paula Harris and David Coote. Paula's book, Connecting the Dots, you know, was a really interesting book, and I wanted to say thanks for them as well, and how much I've enjoyed, you know, working with them.
Okay, but so you think that they're out 100-plus light years away.
Yeah, that's just a guess on my part. I know that when I was talking with the teacher, and she was talking about the tall white lady next to her, whose CIA name was Pamela, I remember the teacher stated that Pamela had actually never been back to the home planet, and that one of the trips that Pamela was looking forward to that they were going to take was actually taking her back to visit the home planet.
Did they ever describe their planet, what it looked like, what their buildings looked like? I know you said they live underground, but I'm sure they have structures down there.
There were a few things about their home planet that I was able to reason out based on, you know, by studying them, but there were lots of things that I was not able to reason out. Now, their underground living area, which is also in the mountains, Their main base has two parts. It has the hangar and the base and the place where they deal with the spacecraft.
You're talking about here now, on this planet.
Yeah. Then there are living areas on the mountain peak next to it, and it's all underground in tunnels. I never went down in the tunnels. I never had that kind of guts. I'm not that brave. But I have no idea what it's like underground, I'm not a very brave person. I never want to see what's underground.
It sounds to me, Charles, that in spite of meeting them, you didn't trust them for some reason. Because I'm picking up a fear factor here in terms of things. And you're right. I mean, it would be jarring to know there was an extraterrestrial. It is pretty awe-stricken when you hear something like that. But
it's sort of like being in New York City. There's people in New York City that you could trust with your life. There's, you know, priests and firemen there that you could be burning and they would come and do everything they could to keep you alive. On the other hand, I'm sure there must be people in New York City that, you know, that I wouldn't want to be out on the dock at 10 o'clock at night and carrying $10, you know?
True.
And the tall whites are like that. They're proudly individualistic. And so there were people like the teacher where, you know, you could trust with your life. And Range 4 Harry and stuff, that if You know, as long as you didn't do anything silly, they, you were never at risk. On the other hand, there are other people, like the captain, who are kind of in between. You didn't have to worry when he was around. But on the other hand, he didn't really understand humans very well, and he didn't really want to. He just wanted to come and do his business and leave.
Did you ever see any violence from them?
They never attacked me if they weren't provoked or terrified. They never came just to be cruel or how humans might go and say whip a dog just to see what happens. They weren't like that at all. They were plant eaters, and they believed in tit for tat. If you didn't harm them, they wouldn't harm you. If you didn't,
George, you know, I wanted to add one thing that's really interesting about these aliens, these people, that they were allowed to go off the base, and you might want to, pursue this, to go into Las Vegas. And can you imagine a civilization that thinks that we are made of Las Vegas?
Well, yeah.
Gives new meaning to the number 7, you know?
Yeah, the thing that's really interesting is, and Charles talks about this in his book, he, a couple of times when he was on leave and when he was, they had R&R, and this was Las Vegas in 1965, not Las Vegas in 2005, but he actually saw them accompanied by, he said, intelligence people, and they were wearing wigs and dark glasses. Maybe Charles would like to talk about that because it might be interesting. These aliens did get to go off the base a couple of times in Las Vegas.
I thought I saw some of them a few months ago there.
Yes, they came to a lot. The ones that were used to being around humans, the ones that were the same height we are, or not too tall, they quite routinely would come into Las Vegas, especially at night. Because remember, the tall whites, they love to travel around at night. They know that their eyesight is way better than ours, and their hearing is way better than ours.
What did they do in Las Vegas?
What every tourist does, because they get bored out in the desert, just like you and I would.
Don't tell me they play blackjack.
Well, I've seen them play blackjack. Yeah, described in my books. Yeah, because their eyesight is better than ours. For them, it's not even a game. They always know what the next card is.
I assume we give them the cash to play, huh?
That's my belief. Yeah. One of the places they used to like in the '60s was the casino, the Stardust. The Stardust in the '60s used to have a motif that was like, like being out in the galaxy in space.
They love that.
They used to love that. And they used to, that used to be one of their favorite places.
Sounds like a Star Trek bar, or a Star Wars bar.
Yeah, remember? And when you looked up at the ceiling, it would be our rendition of what it would look like if you were out in space looking at the galaxy. And they used to love to come through at night and, and see that, especially at night. And they used to love to walk around the desert at night and look at the stars, because that is something they couldn't do on their home planet because their atmosphere is much thicker than ours.
True, good point.
But that stretch down by the Stardust on the Strip in the '60s, it was very common to see them down in there.
Would you look twice at them if you saw them walking down the street? I mean, like you said, they're whitish and.
Well, they would disguise themselves.
They look like they're from some rock band or something.
They would disguise themselves to look like humans. And remember, having been in Las Vegas, for a station in Las Vegas, when you walk around Las Vegas, you'd see all kinds of humans, people from India, China, rich people from Saudi Arabia, you'd see showgirls and people who were members of bands that were, dressed up.
You'd see people who didn't even look human.
Yeah, and they would just be actors and actresses. I remember I was there when they were filming some of the scenes from Diamonds Are Forever, so you could see actors and actresses and all sorts of stuntmen all made up to look unusual. And of course, at 2 a.m. in Las Vegas, you see lots of guys that are just sobering up. So when you walked around Las Vegas, it wasn't at all unusual to have somebody who seemed a little unusual next to you, or in the same casino next to you, and you just figure, oh, I guess they came from somewhere that I hadn't been. And if you actually asked the tall whites where they came from, they loved to pretend they were from northern Spain. If you actually pressed them, they'd say they were here on a trade mission from northern Spain.
How long have they been coming here? Now, you saw them in 65, but, I mean, have they been coming here for hundreds and hundreds of years?
Well, in the logbooks in my weather station, I was able to, you know, the logbooks went back 7 years, and the legend of Range 4 Harry, I was able to trace that back to 1954. But I note that the ancient Greeks, in the Greek myths going back to like 900 or 1000 BC, the Greek myths called the star Arcturus the Watcher. And the Greek myths, according to Greek myths, from 1000 BC, a group of tall white gods came to Earth from the Watcher star. And then when the men of ancient Greece were out camping at night in the summertime, these gods would come and stand out beyond the ring of the firelight and just watch them. And so it wouldn't surprise me if the tall whites hadn't been coming here off and on since at least 1000 BC.
They talk about how they got here in terms of their propulsion. Did they come through wormholes? I mean, how were they able to do this?
I never saw any evidence of wormholes or anything like that. Their deep spacecraft could clearly travel faster than the speed of light. And Range 4 Harry, when I was talking with him about on the scout craft, confirmed that the technology used in the scout craft was capable of propelling the scout craft faster than the speed of light, but he felt the scout craft wasn't built very well, and he was quite adamant that nobody in their right mind would take it anywhere near that fast. And although the deep spacecraft clearly made the journey by accelerating beyond the speed many times the speed of light.
You mentioned that Einstein's theories fell short a little bit. Elaborate on that for us, Charles.
Well, as I describe in Hall photon theory, I feel that there are more fields in the world of physics, like the electric field, the magnetic field, and so on, the gravity field. I feel that there's another field, one or more fields that have as yet been unrecognized. And I feel that within a photon that there has to be a third field as part of the physical structure of a photon. Currently, we're told that there's only two fields in a photon, an electric field and a magnetic field. But I feel there's a third one in there. And I feel that if you look at classic experiments like the Michelson-Morley experiment and the Waterfield telescope and so on, that you see this third field at work, that it explains why light sometimes behaves as a particle and sometimes behaves as a wave, that's really the third field that's doing that. And that you can generate this third field using a toroidal coil, which is an electromagnet that looks like a donut. And I believe that, see, when you looked at their scout craft had a double hull construction, and their deep spacecraft also had a double hull construction. And then in between those two hulls, there was like 1,000 miles of fiber optic windings. And then what they would do is they would generate, and it was built sort of like a giant toroidal coil or magnetic, there were different sets of windings. One set of windings served to streamline the craft and protect the occupants from the forces of acceleration.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, it was common for the scout craft, if they powered it up fully, when you saw it out in the desert, it would first, when it was sitting there, it would first look like a craft. You know, you'd actually see the edges and the metal and the
windings. Right, right.
But then when they powered it up, it would take on, when they powered up those windings, a field would be generated around the craft, and it would take on a fuzzy white appearance, offering them radiation protection if they were out in space.
Almost like a force field.
Yeah, and once it became fuzzy white, you couldn't actually see the windows anymore, if you were at a safe distance. One day at a mile and a quarter, when I saw the scout craft landing with that field on it, the field coming from that craft stopped the engine on my truck. It made it seem like nothing electrical.
Well, and we've heard of those things around UFO cases. Yeah.
And once they powered up, they could move a distance of like 7 miles at an average speed of 8,000 miles an hour. They could lift up and they could just go pop, like 8,000 miles an hour, and just stop.
Do you believe that people who have witnessed UFO sightings, Charles, might have been seeing some of theirs?
Might have, yeah. And see, the people on board weren't strapped in or anything. They were just sitting in a seat like you and I sit in our living room chair.
And they were fine because of that force field.
Yeah, and see, if you were to try to do that with rockets, say like on a remote control craft, the forces of acceleration and deceleration would liquefy steel. You know, it wouldn't just turn people into ketchup and everything organic into mush. It would liquefy steel. But the people on board, you know, it didn't even move paper around, you know. I mean, you just sat there like you were sitting in your living room. And see, that takes more physics than what Einstein knew about. And see, when you look at like Alan J. Hynek's Project Blue Book findings, where he had those samples of stuff that dropped off from flying saucers, he described them like in 1968 as looking like the slag from an aluminum furnace, well, that had been heated to 1100 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, that's fiber optics. If you go and take fiber optics and you melt it, you heat it to 1100 degrees Fahrenheit, it's like 49%. Fiber optics are typically like 49% aluminum. And what you'll get is looks just like the slag from an aluminum furnace. The tall whites were very touchy about the heat on those coils. Lots of times you'd see them sit down at the scout craft, and when they got out, the first thing they would do is open up the panels on the back to let the coils cool off.
Hmm.
The deep spacecraft were designed so that everything, including the coils, was completely accessible from the inside. But the scout craft required that you go outside the craft to access those coils.
Did you ever see a craft break down or collide with another one?
Yeah, in my books, in the chapter entitled Two Games and One Board, I described the day I watched the day in 1966. That I saw the coils on one of the scout craft overheat and melt, and they worked from like Wednesday afternoon until Monday morning. The tall whites only, no humans, on those coils. As I described in my book, I got to within several hundred feet before they wouldn't let me get any closer.
All right, stay with us, Charles Hall, Paula Harris. Phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.